Magpie by I. M. Abler, rededicated to my literary hero, E.M.H., a character in his own right. It all began when I saw the partridge. I don't remember ever seeing a bird like that. So the important thing is that I saw the partridge. By the way, my name's Jimmy. My last name isn't really important at the moment. The same goes for my middle name. Now, I was walking through the park, or should I say strolling through the park. Honestly, I prefer the word strolling because it better describes a mode of locomotion I had on that particular day, and it sounds better. It reminds me of that song about strolling through the park. I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but if I think of it, I'll let you know. As I was saying, I was strolling through the park on this particular day, which I believe was a Thursday. It's funny how you can't remember the name of a day until the day is over, and by that time it's too late because you have to remember a whole new day. I personally don't think we should have names for days at all. It would be a lot easier that way. Or if we did have names for days, we should have only one so we couldn't get confused about it. If I had my choice about what the name for that one day would be, I would call it Today. That way, when people would ask what day it is today, I could tell them it was Today. And then we would have this whole big back and forth sort of thing, which is almost always amusing, at least for the first 23 times or so. Now, back to the story. I was on my strolling way in the park on this particular day. Do you notice I use the word particular a lot? I also frequently use the word remember. From now on, I will refrain from using those two words. But how can I remember if I use the word particular or not? Oh well, I guess you're going to have to keep track of it for me. I suppose that we all have certain words that we say constantly. I guess it's like fingerprints or something. But if every person on the world has their own particular words, then there wouldn't be enough to go around, would there? Even taking into account of the fact that there are more than 100 languages, and even if every language has like 1 million words, there still aren't enough words to go around for everybody. It's stuff like that that makes me think of that partridge. Anyways, there was this one time of many when I was thought-like, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere at all, and at no time in particular, a really big, giant, huge, monstrous, monolithic, megalicious, monomaniacal, really quite mega, super-D-duper-big bacterium comes by and starts to infect me. And you know how bacteria are. Once they start to infect, they can't stop, and pretty soon they're inviting all their friends to the big bacterium fest that they're having in my esophagus or larynx or hippocampus or wherever they feel like having their big galas of monomaniacal whimsy. I don't exactly have a total understanding of quite what that last phrase meant, and when I say that, I mean I don't have a clue. So this bigger-than-big bacterium and all his buddies, which I assume he gathered around the time of World War II, now don't get me wrong when I'm complaining about this particular bacterium. Just because I don't like this individual doesn't mean that I'm an anti-bactite or anything. Hey, some of my best friends are bacteria. I have no enmity or ire for the bacteria race, and I wish them all the best as they fight all the racist bigots out there who have nothing better to do than complain about how their parents got infected one time by some bacterium, and how they didn't even have a chance against a low-down, no-good rotten. Well, it goes on from there into a long string of racial slurs, and I think we've heard enough of those in our prejudiced society that claims it has nothing but benevolence for all of bacteria kind. I swear, when I think of how little our society has progressed from the caveman days, when bacteria were afraid to go out in the street from the constant name-calling and bigotry, I get more thought-like than I was when that big bacterium infected me. As I said, that bacterium does not represent his or her race, but it is just because of all the low-down, no-good, rotten bigots in the world that bacteria have a bad name. Not that I have anything against bigots, mind you. After all, some of my best friends are bigots. In my opinion, bigots have gotten a bad rap all of their existence. It's remarkable that there even are bigots to speak of now. Bigots are some of the most despised people on the earth, and all that just because they don't like other people. Everybody doesn't like somebody sometimes. Even the people who claim that they love everyone hate no one, and no one is a pretty big person to hate. I prefer to hate someone, even the most loving person on earth, rather than hate no one. I'd rather mess with a tangible person than being caught up in hating no one. You never know what no one is going to do because no one could change forms at any time. No, sir, I'd rather hate people than hate no one, or even worse, hate ideas. Ideas don't die, so it's very easy to hate them, or love them for that matter. But getting back to my original subject, bigotry as a whole has been given the worst rap in the history of raps. I admire the bigots. Rather than just hate all people, or just one person, both of which can be detrimental to a person, they find a compromising mean. They hate just one group, which is so much better when you think about it than hating all people or just one person. People won't like you if you hate all people, and a person most definitely won't like you if you hate them, with the exception of these newfangled Christians and their whole turning the other cheek nonsense. So if you consider it, bigotry really isn't so bad at all. You can hate some people and not hate others. It's the best of both worlds. It's a funny expression, isn't it? I mean, when you begin to think about it, there should be three worlds, or at least three, depending on if you think there are different levels of heaven and the other place. whose name I cannot remember at this particular moment. Again, if I think of it, I'll let you know, etc., etc. And then if you add in all the planets and all the possible planets that may or may not exist and may or may not have life on them, it's certainly a heck of a lot more than two. So I don't know why people say something is the best of both worlds when it doesn't take a Professor Peabody to know that there are more than two worlds, and maybe more, depending on God or Jesus or Buddha or what have you. Yes, sir, or ma'am, for that matter, I'm pretty afraid of religion. You don't know what it's going to do next. Not like good, steady, God-fearing ideas like coffee or fluorescent lights. Religion gives an excuse for life, and life doesn't need an excuse. It's too full of pride and ignorance. Jesus must be getting really angry in his part of heaven. Everyone got him all wrong. I guess a lot of people misinterpret you when you're the Son of God and all. If you're God, it must be even worse. I wonder if God's religious. I bet you he's an atheist at heart, or at the very least an agnostic. But alas, I digress from more important matters like the status of copper. I apologize ahead of time for delving into such a taboo and sensitive issue, but I feel that I simply must express my views about the issue. I believe that copper is, and always should be, a very important metal to our domestic economy. I don't care what the diehards and aristocrats in Washington have to say about the subject. That is the way I feel, and there's nothing that they can do to change that, except kill me or possibly give me a very large amount of money. But until then, I remain committed to the cause, so much so that I've organized my own grassroots organization, which I call the New Copperheads. We're just like the old Copperheads, except we like Lincoln, hate the Confederacy, and actually have a stand on the copper issue. We're for it. Again, I apologize for going public about such a controversial subject, but I had to express my views. I'm sorry if I offended anyone, but I didn't mean to get anyone's feathers ruffled, especially those copper-hating sons of... I feel I must diverge from this topic before I start to get bad-tempered. I apologize for the brevity and lack of conclusion about this subject, but that's what you get when you're up against a bunch of low-down no-good... I apologize once more for the confusion that I may cause by the rapid change of subjects, but I must halt this course of events at once before my head explodes, not to mention yours, after hearing about those despicable, copper-hating, fatted... All I have to say is this. Sic semper tyrannis! Oh, and also, viva revolution! There. Now, back to a lighter issue. The thing that really bugs me about Jesus is that he's cornered the whole Messiah market. Consider it. It's the most powerful monopoly on the face of the earth. If I wanted to open a store to sell, oh, let's say, copper, then I would be allowed to do so with little protest from anyone. Those that do have a monopoly on copper would consider my little shoddy operation no big nuisance to their massive conglomerate. They'd just wait for it to fail, and that would be that. If I wanted to keep my store open at my own expense, making very little profit because of the dominance of the monopoly, then no one would care. But if I wanted to proclaim myself the Messiah, then people would get into an uproar saying that Jesus already was the Messiah and that I lost my chance. They probably would get all angry in the way that people do when you claim you're the Messiah. I wouldn't even stand a chance because of the complete perfect monopoly that exists today, at least for the majority of the civilized world. It's not as if I'm going to take over the market. Far from it, for my Messiah movement probably won't last past my lifetime. But still, I deserve the chance to compete in this competitive world of ours. It's the genius, glory, and saving grace of capitalism. This all reminds me of a story I read once. The basic plot is as follows. Man on search for gold develops sudden craving for coconuts. He discovers a coconut-waving monkey which leads him through the jungle, this whole story takes place in the jungle, by the way, to a lost city. Although he is treated as a god, he still doesn't have coconuts. I forgot how the story ends. Either the man discovers that the monkey was actually a robot and the coconut was actually a bomb made to lure the coconut zealots to the lost city, which I believe contained a huge hoard of coconuts, which the townspeople used as a low-grade weapon and detergent. Either that, or the man was killed by the natives, carved into 1,000 pieces, and stuffed into a giant raspberry. I can't remember which for the life of me. The only thing I hate more than a politician is a mirror. Looking up at all of one's defects, who needs it? It's much better to go around looking at other people's problems. Another thing about politicians, they always say that we have so many problems. All they say is depression this or deficiency that. The biggest problem in America is that we think we have too many problems. Everyone should just lay back and look up at the wonderment of the world, the heavens, etc., etc. I think the reason that I hate politicians and mirrors so much is that they're some of the most human things out there, and I sure do hate humans. The world would be so much simpler if we just let nature take care of it. Take evolution, for example, or to be more precise, the lack thereof. For we've eliminated evolution. People are always talking about what they think man will next evolve into. Will he have a third eye, less teeth, more appendices? I always have to remind them that man has in effect stopped the process of evolution by creating his or her own safe environment. He or she has eliminated all predators and any other danger which nature might concoct by separating himself or herself from nature. The cause of all this, a human population of something like 1 billion gajillion. This is all going against the natural process. If a population of, let's say, for example, Gila monsters of that size, or should it be amount, existed, it would be terminated instantly. Even nature, who always watches over her or his children, is trying to correct the problem. Consider this. Does any other animal have any sort of illness like that of man? I can't recall an emperor seal getting a cold on record, but the indefatigable species of Homo sapmen has managed to conquer that as well. If there's anything I hate more than politicians or mirrors, it's medicine and doctors. What are they thinking? By saving lives, they're inadvertently killing, disrupting the natural balance. I realize that I should have died a long time ago if it wasn't for those kooky doctors. The plague of humanity. It would all be much better if we would destroy all this civilization stuff and go to survival of the fittest like it's supposed to be. We're not playing by the rules. In fact, we're cheating and making our own rules so that we always win. That's just poor sportsmanship. There's nothing wrong with being naked. You're able to get done a lot of things quicker without clothes, going to the bathroom, for instance, or, since we are currently in the nature motif, going to a large tree trunk. That would be the life. I would only miss two things: prepared food and chairs. I do declare the best human invention in all the progress and development of human technology is the chair. Everything before it was leading up to that great culmination, and everything since has been in decline from it. Imagine living in a world without the comfort and support of the chair. No other animal would think of such a noble idea, actually providing comfort and structural support for our glutamus maximuses, or is it maximi? It's the quintessential human development. I couldn't imagine living a day without the structural integrity and bliss of a chair. If not for the chair, we would actually have to support our own nether regions ourselves. But thanks to the chair, we can let our mind consider more useful contemplations like the growing of corn or the destruction of our fellow man. I couldn't live a second without the psychological comfort of knowing that I don't have to haunch about crouching on my knees all day in order to get a rest from hunting of game, avoiding predators, or gathering some delicious boysenberries. If I could rule a country of any significance, I would devote it entirely to the development of chairs. It would be called Chernibia, or the Association of Commonly Concerned Specimens about the Importance and Development of Chairs Land. That would be happy and good. I wonder what the noun form of happy is. Maybe it's impossible to be in a perpetual state of happiness, so that's why there's no noun form. Wait, no. Happiness is the noun form of happy, isn't it? Well, that was certainly a sock full of poop, now, wasn't it? I've heard that you can't have the word poop on license plates. Does that apply to all forms and derivatives of poop as well? For example, what if I wanted it spelled like poop or pupe? Will they still not allow me to do that? What am I asking you for? You probably don't know a poop about poop anyway. In the future, I will stop asking you questions. Well, unless you want me to ask you questions. Do you want me to ask you questions? Oh, well, if you don't like it, I suppose you can mentally replace all the question marks with periods, couldn't you? That's what I would do. If I didn't like questions, that is. But since I do like questions, it's all just speculation. Answers I don't like so much, but a question every now and then and before can really bring your shoes to full shine. Being famous is one of the loneliest states of being that exists, or ever has existed, or ever will exist, for that matter. But then you have everyone annoying you all the time, which wouldn't be so bad if only they'd stop once you were dead, but they don't stop there. People keep on thinking and talking about you long after you're dead. You'll never have a peaceful moment again so long as you live, and so long as you're dead once you get famous. And yet so many people want this. Some of them are willing to kill for it. And I don't mean just harmless human killing. There are several billion of us, after all. I mean these people, if they deserve to be labeled with that appellative, even stoop so low as to kill living things. And by living, I mean actually living a life worth living. They kill inanimate objects and perceptions and memories and anything that can die, the soul, for example, all because they want their picture taken and their names in bright lights. That's no way to live on. No peaceful way, at least. Because once they reach fame, they're trapped and their anonymity is gone before they realize what it was. I'd like to live on in silence, in the world of dreams and irrationality and fiction and fortresses of copper and Alka-Seltzer and people without watches and crab legs overflowing with pickle juice, and jamborees and yetis and buildings with built-on poles and polecats and people who are quiet and nice, and niceties of all flavors and varieties, and crackers with balloon crumbs that play a song in perfect E-flat, and flats and sharps that sound the same because we want them to, because I want them to, and Xerxes the Conqueror coming to congratulate all the good people on a job well done, with ice cream and soda and sparklers of all colors of the rain, with flowers of halcyon colors, and huge whales and walruses that argue with little sincerity about the state and condition of lollipops, and me there all the time, with a smile and a whistle and a big piece of licorice and playing jump rope because I can and playing hopscotch because I cannot, and no one there, too, cheering me on in his or her precocious way with hugs and trees and broomsticks. That would be the best. Like this one time I was watching this movie on the Devil Box, and I fell asleep in the middle, and when I woke, all there was were credits in front of a picture of a rose. It's been boggling my mind ever since. How did it end? Why did it end? And especially, why did it end when I was asleep? That wasn't very polite. In fact, it was quite rude, if you don't mind me saying so, which you don't now that you've heard the true horror that is that experience. Rudeness is like stubbing your toe and then waking up to find an elephant in your bed and your life in shambles for no logical explanation, except because your mommy said so. But at least I got to see the credits. I'd be kicking myself if I didn't find out who the key grip was, which I believe in this particular picture was Horace D. Landswiddler. Opportunity is a fun thing sometimes, but others it's like an apricot eating your colon and singing terrible Broadway songs because it doesn't really like you. Take Mr. Landswiddler, for instance. At the age of 19 3/16, he found his way, or rather lost his way, to Hollywood, which neither contains holly nor a wood. He started his career, as most key grips do, low on the gripier ladder, as just a plain old regular grip. No, he wasn't even key back then, and what was worst of all, he knew it too. It's a hard, rough life being a grip, but it can all change in an instant. Of course, it can all change back again, and sometimes even worse than when you started, in an instant too. One second you're on top of the world, spitting in your grandma's eye, feeling like nothing can stop you, not a tractor with razor dull blades, not a housefly with an urge to take its business elsewhere, not a jihad involving little children on their quest to rid the world of questions, not an iconoclastic garage sale with half price on everything, even the things they don't have, not even a toilet, or bidet for that matter, filled with crushed cherry pies and oscillating with maximum capacity. And the next second you're in the gutter, waiting for the next issue of Gentleman's Quarterly. No, sir, the life of any grip, but especially a key grip, is not an easy one. Especially if you're a key grip, really. The gripping business is a harsh mistress, and what's worst of all, she knows it too. Harold Finkenthaler knew that all too well. He climbed the gripping ladder in a relatively short period of time. Between the years of 1974 and 1979, he progressed from a coffee boy to a key grip, which means that he was even more key to the gripping of a production than even a key grip. But then, all of a sudden, out of the blue, like a big ball of oyster juice, he couldn't find work anymore. Perhaps it was because he used the old gripping techniques that just weren't in fashion anymore. Or perhaps it was that really strange noise he made when he smelled lime juice. Or maybe it was a series of murders he committed during the shooting of the sequel to the blockbuster live-action Smurf movie. You have to understand that this was the late 70s, and murderer bigotry was at its worst then. I mean, the moment you came out and admitted you were a murderer, that was the end for you. You started to be labeled with degrading names such as killer or lunatic. People started looking at you funny, thinking that you were always watching them and thinking about how to kill them. People started to observe your behavior and mannerisms more closely, thinking that just because you were a murderer, you could be wielding a knife out in public and trying to stab people with it. I'm sure glad those awkward times are behind us. Today, murderers are recognized as people, too. Just because a person likes to kill people from time to time to relieve stress doesn't mean that they have some sort of killing fetish or something. It's just a hobby, like dancing or throwing snakes at people. Some of my best friends are murderers, so I understand this problem more than anyone. There are still those who refuse to accept murderers into society. Some of the most bigoted people in this fashion are leaders of our community. I can't understand how this blatant prejudice still permeates our society. It seems like the only people who understand are those who are involved in the media. They know that murder is nothing to be ashamed of. They give the most of their attention to murderers, hopefully informing and educating the future generations, showing them that murder is not a dirty word anymore. Who knows, maybe they are making a few murderers out of the little children in society. Yes, sir, it seems like murder bigotry is going the way of the dinosaur. Bang, bang, boom, boom. That's what I think about the situation. But all my thoughts are always unfinished. But at least I follow my actions through to the very end, at least those very few actions that I do. From what I hear, everyone else is the opposite, having finished thoughts but unfinished actions. So good job to me for being creative. It's exactly the same way with my attitudes on love. You see, the key to life is not to love everybody, but to hate nobody. Most of the people hooked up on all this love mumbo-jumbo lead miserable and relatively pointless lives. I'm proud to say that I've never loved anybody in my entire life and plan not to love anyone either. But I've never hated anyone either, so I have no worries or cares or heart attacks. That's the way to live life. Hate brings about the worst in people, and besides, this way I might live on for future generations as a role model. During this time, the history teachers will say, lived good old Jim, the greatest loser in the history of the world. I'll be the first person to love nobody who's been awfully neglected in recent times. I'll be the first person ever to go through life without loving anyone, and they'll build great big statues of me, and they'll even start a whole new philosophy based on my life called loserism or Jimmyology. That and a pair of ears makes the world go round. Hate is the way of suckers, yes sir, no doubt about it. Take as example when a group of so-called singers is doing its thing, that is to say, singing, and everyone is laughing and smiling and saying, look at all the singing peoples and all that. When that is going on, I, being a devoted non-singer since birth and raised that way and proud of it, I can look at all the crowd and know what idiots they are. No, wait, I speak too harshly. Harshly to the idiots, that is. After all, they've done no wrong to be associated with a bunch of popinjays. Perhaps I speak too harshly of popinjays, if I even knew what they are. But singing is a skill not to be desired. No, no, no. Humming is where the action is at. Humming is a far grander action than singing, because it has all the melody of singing, but with more annoyance and creativity and country goodness. For humming is all but cacophony to those around the hummer. So it has all the annoyance of singing, but without the hassle of making up words. And this paucity of vocabulary makes humming the more interpretive and therefore more difficult musical art. The hummer is forced, after exhausting his repertoire of melodies, to strain for other compositions, ideally his own. And yet humming is seen by many as a mischievous and lazy activity. I declare that those anti-Hummites are really envious of their more musically inclined brothers. Name a successful singer. It's not too hard, you must admit, but now name a successful hummer. Go ahead. I double-doggy dare you. Not one. Not one in the history of civilization. How's that for progress? But we live on, we that follow the creed of hum. Perhaps we only live on because of the stern resistance and disdain we receive from society at large, but we still live on, humming a happy tune rather than a sad one. It's all very much like the status of eggheads. Every body and mind hates the intellectual, but loves the boorish troglodyte excuse for a brain. Good old D.D. Eisenhower knew that, and that's why he won his elections against egghead Stevenson, who would have been the greatest leader this country ever did have, or will have now. Intellectually, the two men were pretty much equals. They just had one very significant difference. Stevenson showed his intellect, and Ike didn't. The elections of 1952 and 1956 were just like the proverbial dodgeball games of childhood lore. Whenever Stevenson would make a rather intellectual remark, for which he was rather known for, the Republicans would start the name-calling, calling him an egghead, and so forth. And whenever the Democrats would get intellectual with Ike, he'd just smile his grandpa has lost his mind again smile, and play dumb, and everyone in America went, aw, especially the fighting men who looked on him as a father. And the Republicans, whenever fearing that people would actually listen to Stevenson's speeches and may even start to realize that they made sense, they would bring up Ike's war record. His campaign song doesn't mention one political issue, instead it babbles on and on with the I like Ike stuff. And so, when it came time for people to choose who would be on their dodgeball team, they chose the grandfatherly general over the egghead. Ike sure realized how the system worked, and he stuck with his strategy throughout his presidency and elections. He kept that brain of his behind a smile and acted dumb to fool just about anyone who asked him anything. But he took the easy way out. It's men like Stevenson that proved the true intellectual. The reason he's better than everybody is not because he is better than everybody, which he is, but because he knows he's better than everybody and doesn't bring it to anyone's attention, not like those arrogant jocks who go about saying that they're everyone's cup of tea. No, the intellectual, in the end, is the one who triumphs, and it's probably because his triumph doesn't involve parades or cheers or women jumping all around. No, there's no glory in his glory. His is the glory and triumph of being the only person to know that he's got the best of everybody. He had one over on the whole world, and it's so inside of a joke that he's the only one who laughs, and that makes the joke and the world all the more funnier. And that's why the intellectual will never quit, will never die, even though the whole world is trying to turn him around, and even though he probably could change into a mindless popular zombie if he wanted to. And you can take that to the bank. Stevenson sure did once he got all that popularity contest politics stuff out of his head. Don't think he took it to the savings bank, though, that was for sure. The savings bank, or any other well-established establishment for that matter, won't accept that sort of thing. No, sir, all they're interested in is small green slips of dead trees with fancy pictures and numbers on them. I don't honestly think they're worth that much, though. Being humble is one of the most proud things a man can do, besides making a giant statue of himself and then tearing it down. The arrogant man's the one who wants pride so badly that he has to tell everyone he's got it, that talks about his pride as if compensating for the lack of it. The humble man has the true, pure, real pride, and what's more, he knows it too and doesn't have to go about bragging like some blockhead. His pride doesn't have to be announced as it comes down the street playing a sousaphone. It's self-contained, and that's what makes it so real. It doesn't need any verification or approval. Now, you see, hat golf originated not in Scotland, as one would expect, but in Glasgow. It all started when some guy said, "Hey, Bill, you know what would be good and nice and happy? If we played golf with hats." "What do you mean?" asked the other one, whose name slips my mind for the moment. "No, Bill," said the other, that is to say, the inventor of hat golf, "we'd use hats instead of balls." "And what will we use for clubs?" asked the other man, that is to say, the non-inventor of hat golf, whose name I can't remember at the moment. Now, the other man, the inventor of hat golf, thought about this for a real long time, too long of a time, some would say, but of course, these blasphemers wouldn't be fans of hat golf. "Well, Bill," said the man at last, after he had looked up his kilt for several hours, "we'd use hats for clubs as well." "What a lovely idea," said the other. This one was the one who didn't invent hat golf, by the way. Oh, and I can't remember his name, so don't ask, you lousy bum. And so the game spread like a small contained fire, almost immediately put out by the fire department. who had been in the neighborhood because they had been getting a ferret out from a tree, which I believe was a sycamore. And so this terrific sport of hat golf came into being on that fateful day in August, and the rest is history. Unrecorded history, but history nonetheless. Those were some crazy times back then in the hat golf era. They were so crazy that I wouldn't really call them crazy if I were you, or else they'll jump out of the bushes and give you the stamping of a lifetime or two. But then that would only be the case if you were looking at it straight in the eyes. It could understand most anything on the condition that you didn't look at it in the eyes. But that's hat golf for you. Let us never speak of it again. Speaking of, I was speaking of the microwave, or if you prefer, uno de microondas, and I saw the strangest thing I've ever seen. It was so strange that it is blotted out of my memory forever, with the exception of the memory that I know that it was really strange and strange. And I'm not talking about the good hat golf type of strange, I'm talking about the bad Mexican singer with a squeaky voice and baggy pants strange. Not that there's anything strange about hat golf. But that's not my point in all this matter and manner and mapper. No, hat golf doesn't need my praise to keep on a-going in its own special facetious way. Hopeless would be the task of trying to dismantle the unsquelchable power that is the power of the sport of hat golf in today's unsquelchable society. Perhaps one day soon, but not today or any day soon, will the unsquelchable power that is the power of the sport of hat golf be destroyed, or even wounded, or even slandered. So beware, you warmongers. Do not attack the unsquelchable power that is the power of the sport of hat golf. No, it will not fall, as so many other sports have fallen, such as invisible lacrosse and jack-o'-lantern hi-a-lie. As my name is Bill, I swear that hat golf will live on until the ends of days, or maybe even the day of ends, too. I take pity on the poor souls who fight the sport, or any sport for that matter. Just take a look at the antelopes for your inspiration. No, antelopes are meandering creatures with a sense of direction of a hot tamale. Take a look at the gnus. Now there's an animal to look up to when you've got the hat golf blues.